So Derek, good morning, and I'm glad you could be here. I know what is a very busy schedule you have these days. What I wanted to do today, you gave a recent presentation on the directions that accessibility is taking, and I'd like to talk about some of the really interesting things that are going on there. But I wondered if first we might talk a little bit about the current situation. Quite a few of our clients are government sites, and they're facing having to conform to Common Look and Feel 2 by the end of this year. And what we've seen this year is that there are more interactive applications around now, and they are having particular problems meeting some of the accessibility requirements of CLF2. So I wondered if you might have some guidance on what are the most common problems and techniques that these people should be using in their applications.
Sure. It's a little difficult to say without looking at very specific applications, but I know one of the things that we're finding a lot of people struggling with is, you know, how do we deal with accessibility of applications when the current guidelines that we have for accessibility, in particular the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines version 1, were really designed for and written for a document-centric web. And so how do we deal with that? And I think there's still a lot of good guidance in WCAG 1 in terms of what is required. It's just that things we're in a slightly different scenario now. So while we used to have guidance that was designed specifically for documents, now we need to take that jump and take a look at, well, what that guidance was there in the beginning to help people with, say, a visual impairment. The guidance might be there for them to deal with documents in an appropriate way. How do we extend that to providing that type of functionality for someone that's got a visual impairment but is using an application? And I think that's one of the biggest challenges right now is making that jump from the document-centric to the, as you say, to the interactive, where we're interacting with things rather than just reading them.
So I think that, you know, the page layout and navigation stuff is still relevant, as you say. And one of the things that happened, I guess, with Common Look and Feel Round 1 was that there were a number of applications around at the time, including, for example, interactive mapping. And quite a few of those interactive applications got an exemption at the time. And now they're no longer getting exemptions. So suddenly a lot of people are having to, you know, climb a steep hill very quickly to get CLF2 compliance. And in particular, you know, the requirement for applications to still be meaningful if JavaScript or any scripting is turned off. So how do people kind of building these applications, how should they deal with that particular requirement?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. If we were building a use case in a scenario that we need to deal with, and you know, I certainly don't want to disregard that. But some of the interactivity certainly could be made, possible not using JavaScript. It just won't be as snappy. So the way that we generally deal with things is that we make sure that there is a fallback just in case JavaScript is not on. But we also go to the extra step to make sure that we're dealing with the use case when JavaScript is on and assistive technology is in place. Right. And we actually go to the point of making sure that the JavaScript that is there works properly and appropriately with that assistive technology. So while the JavaScript off use case is still something that needs to be there, it's not the only thing that we need to take into consideration. So simply by making an application work with JavaScript on or off does not necessarily mean that it's going to be accessible, even though in traditional terms that's what JavaScript accessibility was all about.
Okay, so what are some of the problems then that you have to deal with trying to make JavaScript working properly with assistive technology?
There's a few things really. One is that quite often people, when they're using JavaScript, they will attach JavaScript to random places in their interface. So instead of having a button or a link that they click on to invoke some JavaScript, they will put the JavaScript on a random component in the page, maybe just to get a little technical, just sitting there on a div or on something else that's in the page that wouldn't normally be functional. And that's one of the issues that we see quite often is, and that's not necessarily an issue of JavaScript, it's where people have chosen to to attach the JavaScript.
Right.
So the JavaScript, you know, if we want to make sure that it works appropriately with assistive technology, it's much more appropriate to put JavaScript on a button or on a link than it is to put it on some other random component in the page, simply because links and buttons are something that a normal user would interact with regularly, and so they're used to interacting with those. So just because we can attach JavaScript to a div doesn't mean that we should. We should really consider other things like placing it on a button or a link or you know, some other mechanism or some other component of the page that actually makes a bit more sense than just something random.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the biggest problems that we see. Another issue that we find is that people are tending to use JavaScript and Ajax for everything now.
Right.
And there's not necessarily some thoughtful consideration to which interactions should we be using Ajax for and scripting for, and which ones should we not be using them for.
Right.
Now, there's a tendency to over Ajax everything now.
Right.
So every little interaction, even interactions that go off to the server and bring back a large chunk of data that is coming back to the screen to change a significant portion of the screen,
mm-hmm.
That's something where we should actually consider doing a more traditional full page refresh if we're changing
right.
that much of the page.
Uh-huh.
So we typically look for opportunities to use Ajax where you're only changing a smaller portion of the page. So when
right.
when you see something, the starting state of the page, and you click on something and that brings back another version of the page with only one or two small things changed, those are perfect
yeah.
times to go and create an Ajax interaction.
Right.
There's other times where if you're changing 50% of the page, perhaps it's not the best use of the interaction or the resources to be using an Ajax-based interaction at that point.
Okay, that's a very interesting point. It reminds me of another issue that we're seeing as well. In the past, if you had a small amount of scripting on your page or whatever, if you went through it in a linear fashion as someone does using a screen reader or going through the structure of the page, it would still be pretty much matching what we see visually on the screen. But what we're seeing now is that because people are adding Ajax and scripting in different places on the page, it's no longer the linear representation of the page is now nothing like what sighted people see on the screen. So in effect, developers and designers are having to now design explicitly what the page will look like in a non-visual presentation. And it's really about how should developers and designers create a meaningful structure to their pages for non-visual representations.
Indeed, I think it's something that that we're missing at this point, because one of the things that we're seeing with some of these interactions is that we're bringing new content into the page, or in many cases, there is content that's in the page that is just being hidden and saved for later. And so they're in, very bizarre places. You're seeing all kinds of applications where status messages might be loaded up into the page to start with, and then people are using JavaScript or some other Ajax-type interaction to selectively show and hide all of the error messages. Well, if you're experiencing that and you've got all your error messages that are at the beginning of the page, it just doesn't make sense as you're reading through it in a linear order. Likewise, people are going with scenarios where they're doing some sort of Ajax interaction. They're bringing new content, and they're just bringing it into the bottom of the page rather
right.
than
mm-hmm.
Somewhere that's very close to, like, say, we click on a link and we bring in some new content. It might make most sense to bring that new content and place it right near where the link that we clicked on. But quite often what happens through convenience or whatever other reason, the new content is coming in and it's just being put in at the bottom of the page with no logical means to get from the link upon which we clicked to get to that new content that's been brought in. So that's exactly the concept that we've been trying to advocate is the idea of having something logical there so that we've got some rescue points, so that if something happens, something in this interaction doesn't go quite right, how do we recover from that? And having those various rescue points within an application are actually very, very useful. And the rescue points are, you know, they can be anything, simply from having well-structured headings in the page so that it's easy for someone to get around. If we use some type of JavaScript to place somebody in a particular spot on the page, or we bring in some new content, we need to reconcile the fact that we might put them in the wrong spot, and if we do that, then we need to have some logical places for them to go. So we typically take a look at an application and we'll say, well, in this application there's, you know, four logical places to go. So that if we get lost, we can start over at one of those four places. And so we'll typically do things like placing a heading at the beginning of that section that is very clear and says, this is what this section does. And by doing that, we enable people to jump around the page a little bit more easily, so that if they do get lost, if they do get disoriented, we can bring them right back to that spot, or they're able to get back to where they were in a much easier fashion than if they were just sort of left all alone.
Right. And I think it's ultimately a very positive thing that designers do now have to explicitly design that interaction. So that leads on to, I guess, the next thing I'm interested in, and you mentioned this, is that the direction that standards are taking in order to deal with these new developments, in that the standards seem to be moving in a direction where they're no longer considering the details of the technology and saying, for this kind of interaction, there must be an accessible alternative. But they seem to be moving more towards task performance as the key. Can you tell us a bit about those standards and how they're moving in that direction?
Sure. It's really been an evolution of the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines. The first version, which came out in 1999, was very much focused on HTML-specific techniques and issues. And what has happened over time is that people have been, it seems, more interested in other technologies. People are interested in Flex, they're interested in Flash, in Adobe's Air, in Ajax-based interactions, and PDF accessibility. So what has essentially happened with the new versions of the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines, WCAG 2.0, is that it's become a set of guidelines that are, at least in theory, technology agnostic. So it's there's no longer specific. There will be specific techniques for satisfying these criteria in HTML, but the core change is that these are a set of underlying principles that can be applied to literally any technology, including those that don't exist yet. Somebody might come up with another piece of technology tomorrow that they can look at and say, okay, look at this set of guidelines, and they will have a better understanding of what is required. For example, several of the old guidelines in WCAG 1.0 were towards specific techniques for keyboard interactivity within HTML. So there is talk about tab index and providing a tab index and access keys and lots of other techniques. Those are essentially all techniques for keyboard accessibility that apply to everything. Those issues aren't exclusive to HTML. So what has happened now is the guidelines have been rewritten to be more technology agnostic, and they would apply to everything. So the guidelines now say things more like a mechanism needs to exist to be able to effectively navigate with the keyboard. They don't necessarily go and say, use access keys, use tab index, provide skip links. So it's actually been a little bit, in my mind anyway, quite liberating, in that we're seeing that accessibility isn't just about HTML, it's about how we interact with whatever piece of technology. And that, in my mind, is the most satisfying part of WCAG 2.
Right. One of the things we try to do with our clients is to point them in the direction of not evaluating a website, but evaluating the customer experience, evaluating the task performance, setting some targets and metrics. And I think from what you were saying, that the standards are moving in that direction too. In other words, they are saying things like, for a particular task, someone using different kinds of assistive technologies must be able to complete that task successfully and effectively.
Exactly, and that's... you know, it's wonderful. I think what we're seeing now is, in the past, we used to see people relying on the checklist and saying, this is what we need to do in order to make our websites accessible. And I think what's happening now is people are looking and seeing, we've got this set of guidelines and a checklist to help us, and compliance with that is important, but just as important in terms of meeting the guidelines of the checklist is the actual performance itself. And that's one thing that is absolutely critical, is not just are we meeting these checkpoints, but can people perform the tasks that they need to be able to complete.
Right. And I think a great side effect of that is that you cannot know that without involving those people in your design and development process.
Exactly. It is wonderful because it really leads people down the path that this is about the people that we're actually trying to engage with on our sites. It's not just about the checklist. And I think what has happened over time is that people are realizing now that the checklist is simply an artifact of years and years of experience with actual people. And so I think that's, you know, the checklist is the starting point, but the people are the end point. That's the beauty of it now. I think we're starting to see the intermingling of the two, where we're seeing that end user experience. If we can't test with everybody or people with all different types of accessibility needs, we've still got this checklist and guidelines to help us provide an experience for everyone, but we still want to do as much as we can with real people.
You've talked about WCAG 2. When is that likely to become released?
That's a very, very good question. I would hesitate to even guess, although... Yeah. And this is I'm not sure who's to blame for this or if there is any need to even blame, but it what keeps happening is people are becoming really passionate about it and voicing their concerns with what's in the current version of the guidelines. So we actually went to, there was a last call for comments, and there was so much feedback that came in regarding the guidelines. They didn't go back to the drawing board, but they had to rewrite sections significantly. So it's continued. So there's a continued cycle of revision. So for any of us to say, I think we've been saying for a few years now, and when I say we, I mean those of us in the accessibility community. I'm not necessarily involved with WCAG 2 and its and whether or not it comes out in a spec form at any point soon. But we've been saying for a while that sometime next year. And I think we've been saying that for a couple of years now. So I'm hesitant to say, but I'm feeling good that it will happen in some time hopefully within the first portion of 2009. Right.
Mm-hmm. Real soon now, I think, is the...
Yeah, exactly. Real soon now.
Real soon now. I know that there's also a separate group working on which internet applications. Is this part of the issue, or is that likely to become more important to people building applications like interactive mapping and so on?
Yeah, a separate group from the W3C, you mean?
Yeah, I'm thinking of the YARIA group.
Right. Yeah, the YARIA group is actually very closely tied to everything else that's going on in terms of WCAG. So I would say it's well coordinated. I think part of the problem now is that we're kind of dealing with uncharted territory, trying to codify some of the stuff that we've just never had to deal with before. And so what's happening in WCAG right now is there's an evolution of another spec that basically helps us specify in our code what a web application should do, because we simply don't have all the tools in HTML that we need. And so we quite often come up with custom solutions. And so WCAG is, you know, essentially a way for us to create the kind of interaction that we would have at the operating system level with a web page. So if we put a tree into a web page or into a web application, that tree will actually be recognized as a tree by the assistive technology. So there is, you know, one thing I will say, though, is the ARIA stuff that's happening is separate from WCAG as a whole.
Right.
So I'm not sure that it's really... you know, part of the reason that things are slow, but I mm-hmm. certainly think one of the reasons that we're finding things slow going right now is just because it's new, even though it's not, I mean, WayArt has been around for about 3 years that people have been working on it. But the support in screen readers and browsers and other assistive technologies and developing test cases, that's a lot of work to deal with all the different possible scenarios, because we're basically recreating operating system level functionality within the web. So there is a lot of work that needs to be done there. Something as simple as writing a test case, you know, it may seem fairly trivial, but there's actually a significant amount of programming work and that needs to go into it at all levels, from the person that's creating the test case and showing the examples on the web, to the people that are building that support into their browsers, and to the people that are hooking into that from the operating system level to be able to work with the assistive technologies. So there is a tremendous amount of work that needs to be done there.
Mapping is a really interesting area, because it's one of the first, I think, that's really pushing a lot of these accessibility issues and interaction. So I know you've been working with Google and using Google Maps. Can you tell me about some of the accessibility issues of interactive mapping that you've been dealing with and just how you've been tackling those?
Sure. There's actually quite a few different issues, and one of them goes back to what I had mentioned before in terms of just simple things like the controls. I mean, there are, you know, there's significant JavaScript that's being used to power any of the maps, and it doesn't really matter whether it's Google Maps or we see the same issue with MapQuest or you know, Microsoft's Maps. Anybody that's got some mapping technology right now, they all seem to be doing very similar things. The controls, for one part, are something that are just not accessible by default. And so what we've been doing is working with creating alternatives, so that whenever we do a custom map implementation, we ensure that we put in our own set of custom controls that allow people using a keyboard to have full access to zooming function, to panning functionality, to be able to change their views.
Right. So is it not enough?
Because it's not there by default.
Okay, and it's not enough to have tabs or to rely on the mouse keys for those functions?
That's actually what we're doing, is we're providing the ability to use the enter key and use the keyboard properly. So what you'll find in most maps, if you try to tab to the controls that are in there, the zooming and the panning controls, if you try to use the tab key to access those, you just simply can't.
Right.
So what we've been doing a lot of work with is replacing those controls with something that you can tab to. Mm-hmm. That's an intuitive control that you can use the tab key, you can use your use your keyboard to fully interact with.
Right.
That's been one of the big changes. The other thing that we're working on right now is trying to help people understand what the context of the map is, because you and I have talked about this before. When there's a seemingly overwhelming problem with interactive mapping and accessibility, and that is that there's just so much data that's there. How can we provide an alternative to everything that's visible in a map?
Yeah, and that what's in the map is really in the eyes of the beholder. Someone who understands geography and soils will get something out of a map that I wouldn't.
Exactly, and so that's one of the big things that we're working on right now, is helping people to understand the map. There are, and I don't want to, you know, break it down in this very, it's a very simplistic view, but in some cases there's the map for the map's sake, and in other cases there's the map for a particular application.
Right.
And so what we're particularly focused on is looking at the map and what its particular use case is in a scenario, and trying to help people understand that it's not just the map itself. When the map is being used in a particular application, there's a reason for it. Mm-hmm. And so that map will tell you things, or you want that map to tell you things, and that's the alternative that we need to get across. And so a very simple example is when you're looking with Google Maps and you're getting driving directions, they always do a really good job of, you know, you have your route that is mapped out on the map, but they do an excellent job of providing an alternative, which is the step-by-step driving directions.
Right, yep.
Right. So they've done a really good job there of providing an alternative to that particular use case for the map. Mm-hmm. So what we're helping people with right now is defining what the use cases are for their maps and trying to make sure that we're providing an alternative that satisfies that use case. And that may be an alternative that's built into the map itself, mm-hmm. or it may be some alternative representation that's outside of the map.
So the alternative representations are sometimes the key to getting the task completed, not using the map with some accessible means, but actually taking a different approach to getting to the data?
Exactly. In some cases, it may be that we need something outside the map to help complete a task. In some cases, it may be that it's simply something where we want to do it within the map itself, and so that there's an accessible means within the map to mm-hmm. to complete the task. It really does depend on the task that we're trying to complete, whether we're trying to map out a route or see a particular overlay of data or some combination of the two. I mean, it really depends on what we're trying to accomplish, and so the means that we choose or suggest to implement really depend on that end use case.
Right. So the whole thing really centers around what are the use cases, what are the insights people get from a map or from the data. It's not about looking at the map itself and trying to make it accessible in some way.
Exactly. I mean, there are certain things that we do need to do at that level
mm-hmm. right.
in terms of making the map accessible itself. But for the most part, what we're really after is that end use case. What are the insights? What are the tasks? What are we trying to actually complete? What tasks are we trying to complete with this map?
Okay, so we've nearly finished. Talked a bit about the current state of standards and development and where things are going. But I know you have a passion and a vision about where you think this should be going, how we should be thinking about providing an experience to a universal experience, I guess. You showed some pretty cool sites in your recent talk. What if you could just tell us a bit about how we should be thinking about accessibility in the big picture.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I continually come back to these applications that are, there's a lot of work being done in terms of data visualization right now. And what I'm really, really hoping for and passionate about, and we're actually trying to work on an application right now that tries to embrace this, is it's not just about data visualization. It's about providing ways in which people can actually interact with and experience that data. So, in an application that we're working on, we're working on, providing an experience that helps people understand what the data is about. So, we're working on something right now with heart rate data as it relates to, athletic competitions. So mm-hmm. we'll be measuring heart rate data and our GPS coordinates and speed and altitude and all these other factors that we're measuring. And we could simply provide something that gives a text-based representation of heart rate at any given time, and that would be something that would be accessible to a screen reader by saying mm-hmm. The heart rate at such and such a point in time was 165 beats per minute.
Yeah.
But what we're trying to work on is trying to figure out how can we make that concept of 165 beats per minute more universal. So how does that impact somebody that can't see but has never, or sorry, that can see but has never experienced their heart rate at 165 beats per minute before?
Right.
How do we make these things available to everyone? So mm-hmm. We're working on a component of this application right now that takes the heart rate data, and not only does it provide the text-based representation, we're taking that text and making it nice and large so that somebody that's got low vision can see it.
Yeah.
We're adding in audio so that we'll have a heart beating at 165 beats per minute at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
We'll also show the heart visually pulsing at 165 beats per minute, because what we're really trying to do is create an experience for people so that regardless of their abilities, they have a bit better understanding of what 165 beats per minute or 180 beats per minute actually is. And so we're trying to approach things from that perspective, not what's the alternative for somebody that can't see and is using a screen reader, but what is something that will provide as an engaging experience for everyone, for somebody that, you know, and we're not even talking about just people that can't see. What about people that are auditory learners, right?
Absolutely.
That are fully, they're fully sighted. Yeah. What if they're an auditory learner and they really prefer to hear things? So we're trying to take things in that perspective, to look at that, as you said, that overall experience that is as accessible as possible and understandable as possible to everybody, regardless of their whatever faculties they may have.
Yeah, and that takes it way beyond accessibility. And it wearing my other hat, outside of this life, I teach music, and I know that people do learn in different ways. Some learn by instruction, some learn from text, some learn by observation, some learn by feel, and some are more visually dominant, some auditory dominant. And so it's great to hear that, because it really ties that all together. It's beyond just the you know, immediate interaction, the sensory perception. It's about helping meet people's learning styles and preferences by providing this experience in multiple channels, I guess.
Exactly, and I think that's why, you know, personally, I see so much good happening in the web right now in terms of it being a more engaging experience. I mean, the web did just start out as just text, right? And it was really, it was reasonably effective, but quite boring. and now we're in a scenario where one of the examples I used the other day was the data visualization of the Radiohead song, where the video is playing and it's all created from data points. So there's data there to be represented, but the actual interaction with that on the web is just, it's magnificent to see Tom York singing this Radiohead song. When it's not actually him, but it's in an application that is showing the movement of his face and plotting everything.
Right.
And I think there's so much to be done there that really helps this digital and physical divide that we have, that's bringing things so much closer together. And I think of how much can be done for people with disabilities and with all different, you know, ways of all different modes of learning, or you know, however you want to. You know, however you want to look at it, there's just so much that is being done to create those experiences that are meaningful to people. It's it's really quite fascinating right now, and I'm
right.
It's a good time to be very excited about what's happening on the web.
So for people who want to keep track of the new developments in accessibility, are there particular places and people besides yourself that they should be tracking and following that you'd recommend?
Sure, I certainly wouldn't say specific people. I mean, there's a group of us, of accessibility people that are really trying to push things on the edge here. And a lot of the stuff that you'll see, from my money, one of the best resources out there is still accessify.com, which is a tremendous clearinghouse of sort of the latest and greatest in terms of accessibility and what's going on. Mm-hmm. If it's an accessibility related issue, it's usually found on Accessify. Which is started by a gentleman by the name of Ian Lloyd over in the UK, and it's a great resource. It continues to have, you know, interesting tools and tidbits and opinions. There's also things, I'm associated with the Web Standards Project, and so there's things happening on the in the world of accessibility. You'll find things quite often discussed on the Web Standards Project as well. So those are certainly a couple of resources, and there's a number of other accessibility related blogs that are fairly interesting and keep up to date with this type of thing.
Right. Great. Well, thank you for taking time out today to talk about accessibility.